Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that 8-show a week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is an effect built in myth and mystery.
So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Well, finally, this is the moment. After many requests from fans of the podcast, and as we near the end of season 6 of the podcast, my guest for the next 3 episodes is stage titan and living national treasure, Anthony Warlow. Mr. Warlow has been thrilling audiences from the moment he arrived on the theatrical scene, and has successfully inhabited a diversity of roles on operatic and musical theatre stages. His versatility also gaining him an honoured place on the international stage. From his debut with the Australian Opera in Benjamin Britten's A Midsummer Night's Dream in 1980, he has left an indelible stamp on the industry, both at home and abroad. Anthony Warlow's lengthy stage credits include the London National Theatre production of Guys and Dolls, making his musical theatre debut with the role of Skye Masterson in 1986. Anthony is preparing to go back on the boards as charismatic lawyer Billy Flynn in Candor and Ebb's Chicago. He joined me at the conclusion of a long rehearsal day. He was very generous with his story and anecdote, charm personified. He shared great wisdom, passion, and insight, all of which we can now relish in this trio of episodes. Anthony Warlow's career is triumphant, but it has also been met with occasional challenge. But through it all, he has firmly established himself as one of our greatest interpreters of character and song, demonstrated through an extensive resume in opera and musical theatre.
Stand well back, I'm coming through. Nothing can stop me now. Watch out, world, I'm warning you. Nothing can stop me now. Now I know that there is a promised land. I'm gonna find it and how. Hope is high and I'm gonna cling to it. Tie every string to it, give everything to it. I'll make all my dreams come true before my final bow. How I'll do it, who can say? But I know I will someday. Watch out, world, I'm on my way. Nothing can stop me now. I shall find success today. Nothing can stop me now.
Read Noel Coward.
Oh, good.
Is he going to talk for that long?
Let alone, let alone.
Yes, good. You're comfortable?
Yeah, very.
Yeah, good, good. Well, Anthony Warlow, thank you so much for joining the Stages podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If I had a dollar for everyone who said, when are you going to do Warlow? I want to hear Anthony Warlow. And I said, it's coming. It'll come one day. And now it's
It'll come.
So thank you so much for being part of the alumni of the podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Very, very nice to have you here. Anthony, you've got extraordinary talents. And one of the talents that I've always admired is your talent for mimicry. When did that all start? Was that as a boy?
Yeah, at school. I used to impersonate the brothers at Edmund Rice College. And the most famous was Brother Bell, Anthony, and then there was Brother Peelan, and Brother Hayes, who was a beautiful man, and and then there was a wonderful man who actually came, Brother McMahon. When I got into the opera, I was doing Puck, he came to, he just turned up at the stage door with a box brownie camera. And he used to walk around the playground with his cassock, and he would have his hand tucked behind him, and he'd say, "Copper for the missions. Come on, Snow. Copper for the missions. Be good." And he had a comb over. So I was in my element, you know, with like physicalities and voices, and that's kind of where it started. But I used to love cartoon characters, because I was one of those people that would get up at 6:30 before school, and I was allowed to watch until 7:30. It was cartoons.
So Hanna-Barbera.
Hanna-Barbera, all the...
Fred Flintstone.
Yeah, all that.
Wilma!
All those things. So, and some years later, someone said to me, "Why don't you do, you know, voiceovers and things?" And I thought that I'd love to. I'd actually really love to. Then, you know, opera and work came in, and it just went by the by. But so that's how it started.
It's obviously the beginning of a developing ear. You need a good ear to be able
to... You do, and I've been blessed with that, and I know that that's a gift, and it has been the thing that has helped me in the career as well, obviously, with voices. And I am less of now, but I was a perfectionist, to my detriment in many ways, but I was never happy. In fact, you know, as I sit here now, we've just come from rehearsal from Chicago, and we went through a scene today, and I was not happy with what I was delivering. And I said, jokingly, I said, "My middle name is Mayer, my last name is Kulpa." And I feel like I don't want to derail a scene by not being prepared. It's not about having it right. Look, I'm more than happy to make mistakes. And I think that's the way to learn and to become more comfortable. But there are things that, just in my makeup, that I stick to, and the older I get, I guess they become more prevalent because of aging and being able to remember things correctly. And you know, it's almost like there's a little voice inside saying, you know, "I told you so," or "You used to be able to, so why can't you now?" There's those elements that have tend to take over sometimes.
It's not bad aging, isn't it? It's hard to realise at certain points when the flesh is willing but the body is weak.
Yes, indeed.
But there's all sorts of bonuses that come along with not giving a damn anymore or caring as much.
And it's really interesting because this process now, I mean, I'll be honest with you, when COVID hit, I was about to commence rehearsals for Secret Garden, the 25th anniversary. I was absolutely excited and over the moon to revisit that beautiful character. I'd had a vocal success with it. I'd had an actorly success with it. And it was my introduction to Lucy Simon. And sadly, now we've lost Lucy. But my relationship with her just blossomed from that time. Then, of course, COVID happened, as I say. And it's been almost 4 years without major work. I've done things. But that element of, you know, is the world telling me something? Is it time to slow down?
Mm.
And to be honest with you, if that was the case, I'd be more than happy to just stop, because I'm very proud of what I've done. But at the same time, those kickstart moments, like this show here now, and yes, it's been a bucket list role. You know, there were moments years ago when it was like an on offer, and I was doing something else, so just couldn't do it. Saw the show originally at in the Encores in 96, or 95, whatever it was, 95 I think it was, and then it went to Broadway in 96, and saw it at the Ambassador Theatre with that cast, and enjoyed it, loved it, thought it was great. Had seen the original production in Australia with Nancy and Daryl Dean, and Terrence Donovan, I think, was playing...
Yeah, Billy Flynn.
I was with the opera company at the time, so I was literally going downstairs to the drama theatre to have a look at that, and thought it was a standout show. And then when I saw the production in New York, it made more sense to me, funnily enough, because of just the black and white and the simplicity, the culling of a lot of stuff. And Gary Christ, who of course is our choreographer at the moment, is a wealth of knowledge. He's the last conduit to the Fosse legacy, and is a beautiful man to work with and a wonderful choreographer. And the stories that he was telling us about Candor and Ebb and Fosse going into a hotel room for 3 days to cull, and cull, that gag's gone, I'm giving up my gag, that gag's gone, to whittle down this script, which, when it is performed as written, not paraphrased, is perfect. Mm. It's a really smart, intelligent, and very witty, witty script. So that's the other thing. And I, you know, going back to that perfectionist thing, I rattle my brain about making sure that every word that is written is said. Sometimes vernaculars don't make sense to me. Mm. So I go into the history side and try to work out why, or a dialect which may bring that up. Little things like either and either, you know, using those terminologies make a lot of sense when you know that if it's Chicago, and I believe in this case that Billy Flynn is a local. They were talking about accents and dialects and getting that, you know, mid-Atlantic sound, which is easy for everyone. But I always want to go the little extra mile and go, well, okay, if he is that, maybe he has been to New York. And, but there's not exactly the Chicagoan or whatever the thing might be, but of that father, you know, talking like a little bit like that, then you become a gangster. And he's not a gangster. He's dark, but he's not a gangster. So you've got to sort of put those little words in here and remind the ether that he comes from that part of America.
Well, it gets back to the musicality of the spoken voice as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and that's a big thing. Mm. Now, maybe, and I'm going off on tangents here now, as is my want, the Welsh background.
Yeah.
My grandfather was from Wales, and so there may have been that sort of that lyric, you know, sing-songy thing to find tempi in dialogues. This particular dialogue is machine gun fire. It's that old, when you watch those old black and white movies of the late 30s and 40s.
It's a particular style.
Oh, the dialogue is really... bang, there's your payoff. And it's difficult. Thank God I've done GNS.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
And those patter songs.
Yeah.
You talk about Fosse and the writers getting every word right, whether it's sung or spoken, but also it's that choreography. Every hand gesture, every head turn, every pop of the knee
absolutely
has a meaning. Yeah. It is loaded from Fosse, passed on to Anne Reinken, who,
that's
of
right,
course, choreographed this production.
That's right, that's right.
Originally.
Yeah.
So there's lots of reasons why it's the second longest running show on Broadway.
Yeah. And it is a wonderful night out. You know, I know that, you know, companies who have done it for 3, 4, 5 years and people who have been in them, yes, they can get a little lazy. That can happen. And even, you know, Tanya, our director, has been talking about performances that she's seen recently. She thought, gee whiz, you know, you've got to get in. And there's that old adage of, you know, the director's in tonight, so the show picks up. It shouldn't. It should be that show. We all know that. But, you know, we're human, and things get a bit slack now and then. And it's natural.
The punters have paid their money. They want to see
that
was delivered.
That is right. But hopefully the muscle memory and the work that you've done,
technique,
the backstories that you've delivered, they keep you buoyant. You know.
Back to that musicality of the mimicry in the schoolyard. At the same time, were you in choirs? Was there a music education?
Yes, it was. I was with the conservatorium in Wollongong at the Wesley Hall in Crown Street. And the conservatorium was a branch of the New South Wales Con in Sydney. And they were starting up, you know, a schooling system there. And so my teacher, when I was 11, my father came home after work and sat me down in the lounge room and said, would you be interested in learning to sing correctly, you know, with a teacher? And I said, yes, I would. I had auditioned at the time for the Arcadians Musical Theatre Company, musical comedy group, as they were then, for Oliver. We did a production of Oliver. I didn't get the role, but I was in the chorus as an urchin. And that end of that year, I started work with Mari Driscoll. Mari Driscoll was a beautiful singing teacher. I was with her for about f- 5 years. And then she left Wollongong because she gained a chorus position with the Australian Opera. So she left. She would come down to do a few, like, you know, mentoring moments with the conservatorium. And I stayed there, went to school, and then left school. It was 1977 that the conservatorium, I gather, received some money from the New South Wales government, and they were able to do sort of pro-am productions, and they were called the Conservatorium Theatre Company. And the first thing I did for them the year I left school was a production of Man of La Mancha. And I'd come to I was Rockdale Musical Society. I remember the director, Heather Pulsford, in Wollongong, had taken me and a friend to the show to see. And I don't recall the man who played Don Q, but it was a terrific production. And I guess she was looking at ideas for her production in Wollongong. And it was probably, I don't know, 6 months later that auditions started. And I knew, I was only just 18, and I thought, you know, they're not going to even think of me. But I was so desperate to play this. I'd read the book, which is a tome, not at home, but a tome. and it was a journey to read it and to make sense of Cervantes' work. And then that was the beginning of wanting to know histories, wanting to know backgrounds. And so my father, who was a beautiful photographer, portrait photographer, took me to Sydney. I went to Motley's, which was, I don't think they're there anymore, but it was in Pitt Street, across the road from the Wesley Centre. And it was a, you know, makeup shop, a lot of Leichner makeups. And they had wig rentals and costume rentals. And I went in and I asked them if they had any kind of attire that might fit in with Don Quixote. Now, this is before auditions had even started. I was so interested in this character.
Dressed for the part.
Yeah, and this guy came to me and he said, here is a wig. And the wig was from the Australian Ballet's production of Don Quixote, and it was worn by Sir Robert Helpman. So I hired this wig for about 2 weeks. I went home and I was about to finish school, and I went into the bathroom with all the makeup that I had. And I designed a face, a character, with all the books that I'd had. I had a lot of makeup books, and I was interested in all that sort of business and prosthetics and things, which I didn't have prosthetic, but I had putty. So I made the putty nose and changed it all. And this was a surprise. So Dad had come home. Two of my sisters were still at home. They were nursing in Sydney, but they'd come home for the weekend. And it's just like it's in front of me now. I had, on the Pi stereo, I had a recording of Richard Kiley singing The Impossible Dream, and of course, I Am I Don Quixote. So when they came home, I was all ready, and I had a bit of an old shirt that I'd found, and one of Mum's blouses, you know, turned around, but it looked like an old thing. And I heard them come in, and I turned off all the lights in the lounge room, and I said, stay there, with this little boy's voice, you know, stay there. And I said, when I tell you, come in. And so I stood by the stereo, put the record on. When they walked in, turned the light on, and I was in full makeup. My sister burst into tears, either because she thought we were being burgled by a geriatric, I don't know. But and I mimed, I am Don Quixote. And Dad said, get in the car, I'm going down and take your portrait. So he went. We got in the car. This must have been 8, 9 o'clock at night. Wollongong, down to the studio, took a portrait photograph of me and loved it, obviously. And he made this most beautiful image. That's the image that I took to the audition, and I was so bold to say. I mean, I was sort of the wunderkind of the theatre company at the time. And I said to Heather Pulsett, I said, do you mind if I'd like to audition? I know I'm young. I said, but I feel this character is in me. And I said, I would like to go behind a screen and do the dialogue. I did the I sang Dulcinea, and I did the death scene. And I said, and I presented her with the photograph, this beautiful portrait, in on the desk. And I said, just look at that, and listen. And this is where the voices and all that music, as you mentioned, the musicality. Yeah. And I did it, and I came out and thing, and she was tearing up. She did. She said, I can't guarantee, but you know that was beautiful. It was lovely. That night at 6 o'clock, I got a phone call saying you're added on cue. And then, of course, the nerves started because I thought, well, you know, I'm 18, but I think I can do this. So so we worked. We worked for probably 5 weeks of rehearsing to get this done. My new teacher, Lynn Williams, not the choir Lynn Williams, but Lynn now. Lynn was in charge of the drama at NIDA for a while. She played Aldonza, and we had locals playing other roles, and the orchestra was in the bit. We did this in the town hall, the concert hall in Wollongong, and we performed the show for 2 weeks, and I had the best time of my life. And then not long after that, long story short, but then I got into the opera playing Puck, and that was the beginning of, I don't know, there is a story floating around that someone from the opera had come down to see this, whether it was because of the subsidy that we were given, I don't know, but someone had been down there, and maybe that was an in, I don't know. But I had to audition for the opera and nearly missed it because we were late coming from Wollongong. A lot of stories.
Peter,
I could go on forever.
That's extraordinary, because you would have been about 18 when you did Man of La Mancha, but obviously had the vocal chops, but were able to manipulate them. So,
well, this is the beginning of making
the feel of an older man.
That's right.
And even making, when you just quoted that line, "I am I Don Quixote,"
sing with that voice. Yeah, that was that's when I thought I need, and you know, I was starting with a classic technique, so I was grounded in a very classic way. But obviously, whatever flaps are around in my throat were able to make the sounds that I wanted to hear for the character, and then it was about making, allowing the technique to support it, and it wasn't just for one day. It had to. I knew it had to be for, you know, 7 shows that week or 6 shows that week. Mm-hmm. We weren't talking matinees at that time, but I had to do it every day, every night. So that was that, and I used to get frustrated because I'd want the dialogue to blend into the vocal. There's nothing worse than hearing a voice for the dialogue and then the sound of the singing.
Beautiful sound, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's the other thing, which was one of my pet peeves, is when I hear people that change, but this is how I sing, you know. I mean, I can go on forever about back phrasing and bending, and it's all about text. The story is the thing that makes sense to me.
Have you had your flaps examined?
Many times, it's been a fascinating journey to go down. I've got little Polaroids of many years of the flaps, and they're all looking pretty similar, which is I think it's pretty good. Pretty proud of that.
In preparation for this chat, I listened to have been listening to On the Boards. Now, I listened to that ad nauseum in the 90s when it first came out.
Yeah.
But listening to it again, you know, some 15 years later, it's extraordinary, those performances that you give with each song, whether it's Max Sennett or The Pirate King or something from Kismet. You transform vocally.
Well,
and listening to it, I can see those characters because you paint such a vivid picture.
That's wonderful to hear.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's paid off.
Yeah.
You know, it's that. And I wanted it to be. I wanted those recordings. The first one we did, which was Centre Stage, I wanted that to just be pit orchestras, like whatever would be in the pit. I didn't want it to be that new thing where the crossover artists were getting, you know, the Philharmonia Orchestra and 57 players playing something that would normally have been 17-piece. I wanted it to sound like the show. And the first recording, we had a certain budget. It wasn't a huge amount of money, but we used what they called boxes. They had synthetic sounds and things. And then because of the success of that album, they allowed me to double the budget. So that On the Boards was, I thought, oh, this is great. I can now go down to that more gravitas characters. But that was an interesting journey for me. I hate that word, but I'm using it anyway. Because as I was recording that album, I was thinking, gee, that really does sound baritonal. It was good, you know. Stand up and fight, you know. Stand up and fight. I thought that sounds good. You know, happy with that. Had I known at the time that there was something happening in my body, which was the cancer, and it had darkened everything. And I thought, this is really strange. That everything's really quite dark. And I remember talking to Moffat Oxenbould, who was the artistic director of the opera, about that. And I said, it was just a fascinating discovery that I think maybe that was part of the darkening of my body was coping, and it was darkening the voice. Because after the surgery and the year later, when I came back to do the concerts, the stuff that I was singing, I was floating all this stuff, and it was light and easy, you know, brighter. I still had those siren-y notes, but they were seen sort of more stellar at the time. I think it was just because the body was free, you know. But those characters were, I thought, what would, in my fantasy world, what roles would I like to play, and what are the best songs from that, you know. And the Max Stennett one, I Won't Send Roses, you know, I know. It's a very real, I find it a really moving and beautiful song.
Oh, it's beautiful, isn't it? It's the most really, unromantic love song.
Absolutely. You know, and
Herman's genius. Yeah.
A lot of the stuff comes from my love of flawed characters. Yeah. You know, a lot of these people that are interesting come from that flawed state. And I'm pleased in a way that I didn't stay down that line of the romantic, you know, heroic stuff, because there's a lot more to, I find a lot more to discover in those other characters.
Oh, that's great characters, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Is there an Albarn in you?
Do you know, it's really funny you say this. That was one of the songs that I thought, I love George Hearn.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And I was fortunate enough to be in his dressing room at the palace when I did Annie. And so all those ghosts were flying around. And I used to do a George Hearn impersonation, and I am what I am, and it's the same thing as I had him, Mrs.
Yeah.
Lovett.
Yeah.
So and to be able to sing that way and to have this beefy sound in this man who was, you know, his life is troubled and different, and it's okay. So then of course John Frost said, oh we have to do you've got to do Albarn. And I said, it was, funnily enough, it was after we did Zhivago, and I'd popped my calf muscle running upstage, and I was in so much agony. And I said, there is no way I'm going on a lift or wearing lifts. I'm not doing that, and I'm not shaving my chest. So that role will never be mine. But yes, it's that sort of thing of, I guess, of wanting to embrace a character and having the safety of going, okay, it's just one song from that, you know. Whether you decide to take on the whole role is another question, but bring flashy moments out.
Were you in the studio every day, or did you go in
every day?
Every day with a different character and focus on that song.
Well, this is the other thing, because it was the first time I'd actually recorded. I mean, in a proper studio. Was Alan Eaton's in Melbourne, and we would do the guide vocals, our guide tracks. So we'd be rehearsed, the orchestra would be rehearsed, and this is particularly for the second album where we actually had an orchestra in there rather than just, you know, six strings, and then we'd double them up and what have you. The second album was quite a trial for me, because I had to change, and I would decide what songs I wanted to do. So if a song was needed to be darker the next day, Stars for instance, I would do a song that was a little more taxing the night before, so that my voice was a little tired but still had, you know, elasticity, and then I could start with there out in the dark and bring that up. So and I was really in charge of producing it, because the guys who did the first album were employed by Polydor at the time, and I was in there they'd never done anything like this. And I will say that I know that Geraldine Turner's Sondheim album was probably the the first Australian
show tunes,
album. Mm. Mine then was the beginning of a plethora of everyone taking over and doing, show. So I kind of pioneered that, and I'm proud of that too. But it was a risk, and I went into it knowing that this could sell, you know, 2,000 units, and that's okay. But I was about to do Phantom with it, with the first Centre Stage album, so I knew there was a selling point for Polydor at the time to be able to embrace it and do it. And they literally gave me carte blanche. The only thing that they said, they would, in each album, they said, you can do whatever you want, but there'll be one song that we want you to do. Okay, so the first one, of course, was that they wanted me to do Bring Him Home. The first track is Phantom, and there's an interesting history behind this, because my theatrical side wanted to start with boom, I have brought you, so that we then get into night time. Right. However, this is not radio friendly. So we didn't just do a da da dee da 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 night time show. We didn't do that for radio. So they played Crawford all the time. They said, this is too hard to play. And I'm thinking, well, they could just cut it in the studio if they wanted to. But no, they chose to do that. And that's fine. But it wasn't the local talent. And we had a version of the local talent, which is a pity that they didn't use it. So we went in and we would do the guide vocal. And the first track we did was Music of the Night. And I sang, that was the first thing we did. And it was probably about 3 PM. And I had a diary going through the whole process, and the orchestra played beautifully. Then I went in and did the guide vocal in the booth, guide vocal. It was the first time I had ever sung it. I'd learnt it, but it was the first time I'd performed this in front of anybody, and it's the take that we used. We didn't do drop-ins, it was, the whole thing was done, that was it. Now if you listen carefully, you can hear keys dropping on the parquet floor near the bass players. Someone's keys dropped, and they tried to sort of get rid of it. It is there. A trained ear can hear it when you hear it, but it's there. And I thought, well, that's terrific. That's what it was. And then from then on, I tried to create songs that if I'd sung them live, that's what they would sound like on the recording. They weren't fixed up or, you know, auto-tuned or anything like that. That's how it was done. Admittedly, there were some things where I thought, okay, I really want to nail this note for posterity, and let's do it. So we might have gone in and done it again and just dropped it in. So getting back to the Bring Him Home, and I said, this is not my fach, it's not the role that I would be playing. Mm. If anything, because of my voice at the time, I'd be a Javert. And they said, well, that's, you know, if you can do it, can you transpose it? And I said, well, it's too high as it is for me, because I'm not a rock tenor there. So we took it down a semitone, and I said, it's still high, but I sang it, and it was a guide vocal once again, and I said, I think I probably should do that again. And the engineer on the desk said, no, because that last falsetto note, home, he said the paper on the board started to vibrate. So he said, you hit, that was that chord, that harmonic was absolutely in the pocket. And he said it wasn't good. So he said, let's keep it. And I listened to it and I thought, yeah, okay, it sounds okay. And that was it. And because people have said, would you sing Bring... No, I won't sing Bring Him Home because it's too hard.
Yeah.
And the older I am now, it was like 30 years ago. I don't know how long ago that was, but...
Lightning in a bucket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they were there, and they're there at least as an archive, you know, which is, you know, it's lovely to have that. I don't listen to them much, though. That was the other thing. When I hit my cancer thing, I just stopped listening. Didn't want to, because I thought, will I be able to do this again? And it was a bit too hard to listen. But I will say that on the odd occasion when I do hear it, it's a shock when people are playing it, or if I hear it on a radio station, I hear something and I go, oh, that wasn't so bad.
That boy's good.
It wasn't so bad, you know?
around the, about that time, a wonderful avenue for exposure for you was the Midday Show.
Yes.
Yeah. Something which is not available to a lot of young performers today.
I mean,
yourself and Marina and became regulars.
Yeah,
and, and Australia got to know you.
Yeah. It was Simon, I can't think of his last name, the director. Simon Phillips? Simon Phillips, yes, indeed. Thank you. He would get me in there and we started, in the early days it was one song. And then I became a regular and had to do three songs. And of course you would go in the morning and rehearse backwards, the last song with Jeff and the band, at 9 o'clock. And so I'd go in and I'd rehearse the last song I was going to sing in the last segment, and then the next one, and then the first one, and then I'd redo that when the show started with Ray saying, you know, here's Anthony singing, blah, blah, blah. And they were nerve-wracking, but I thought this is exposure, this is great. And went down the line going, I can't wear that suit again. I can't wear that tie again, you know. And I never forget a darling man who was a dresser at the opera, Bobby McKenzie, I hope you don't mind. You don't mind me using names, but he became wardrobe master at the opera. And I was doing Guys and Dolls, and I spent the money on this Valentino suit, which was like a grey, it looked like something out of the mafia. I should have just had, you know, gold chains around my neck, but it was a beautifully cut suit, silver. It was like a silver grey. And he saw the show, and I must have been doing something with the opera at the same time. Came in that night, and he was dressing me in those days, and he said, Anthony, he said, don't wear light colours. He said, you look better in dark colours. They're stronger. And I took that on board.
Yeah.
And, you know, he knew what he was talking about. So, thank you, Bobby.
Yeah.
I could do a personation of him, but I won't.
So, starting from the opera, what was it like being in a big opera?
Oh.
But you weren't able to sing.
Oh.
Puck.
Well, I wasn't...
Or it wasn't a singing role.
It wasn't a singing role, but there were... This is the interesting story. There were two elements in the opera, where Puck does sing, or he impersonates, when he's mixing up the lovers, impersonates Lysander and impersonates Demetrius. And Anson Austin was the Lysander, and John Fulford was my Demetrius, our Demetrius, I should say. Now, at the time, Richard Bonning was the artistic director of the company, music director of the company, and he was, you know, in and out of rehearsal. He didn't have much to do with this production. But I decided as a character choice, and because I could sing, it was only a line like I don't know what, can't remember now, Lysander, come hither, you know. I was trying, and I was thinking, how does John sound? He had sort of an airy, Lysander, come hither. And Anson Austin had a very beautiful and thick tenor voice. And so I would impersonate that sound as well. And I put this in the opera, and it was Elijah Mijinski's production. Elka Neidhart was our assistant director at the time, resident director, I should say. And she gave me carte blanche to do that. And I did. And one night, Richard Bonning turns up at my dressing room door. He said, oh, my dear, he said, quite a voice. He said, I'd like to come to my room and have a listen. So the next couple of days, I went in and he listened. I did scales for him. And I said, well, I would love to learn to opera. I said, I've been studying. I said, I know the voice is young, but it was kind of mature for its time, for my age. And he listened to me, and he was impressed enough to sort of give me some coachings with some of the coaches that would come into the company. And then I remember being offered the next season of the opera in Melbourne, the Melbourne season. I was so sad when we finished the Sydney season. It was in January we finished. It was the beginning of their summer season there. And I went to the green room, and that last day, which is the first time I'd experienced this, where all the company, that particular rep company, just sort of sat around having a drink at the bar, and that was their last show, and they said, oh, see, I'm doing Cosy tomorrow, we've got rehearsals for this, coachings. And I sat there and I thought, that's it. that's all there is to it. There's nothing. I'll go home to Wollongong. And I did go home to Wollongong. And then I got a letter from the opera saying, we're doing this next season in Melbourne. Would you be interested in, you know, playing Puck again? And I said, yes, I'd love to. So that was the first time I'd been on a tour. And that there's some interesting stories there, because I went down to find my digs. And I'd been down to a place where they, it was Lonsdale Street, I think, Lonsdale Apartments. And I went in there, and the guy said, I need, I think it was like $3,000 deposit. And I said, I don't have that sort of money. So I rang my father, and he sent it along, and I did get it back. But the rent that he charged me was exactly our living away allowance, $346. And I thought, this guy knows something.
Yeah.
He's taking everything.
Yeah.
So that was it. I mean, I was on, you know, principal wage at the time, because I was a guest artist. And so I did that season, and then went back to did the opera again in Sydney. And during that time, I made my acquaintance with Moffat, who was interested in me as a talent and wanted to keep me in the company, but they didn't quite know where to put me, because I was 19 at the time, and at that stage there was an SO. The SO was sponsoring certain things. John Antonio was a baritone who had won the Sun Aria in this particular year. It might have been 82. And he was joining the company. Moffat, in his wisdom, had set up a system where there would be a principal meeting in the main rehearsal room at the Opera House to determine our future, John and my future with the company. Were we to be opera cadets? There was some way of keeping us with the company.
Because I don't assume there's a young artist program.
That was the time, we were the beginning. Right. We were the precursor to the SO, who then said, we will sponsor the young artist program. So there's a lot of firsts in my career with the albums and this happening. And so I was invited then to stay, put on a principal wage, principal contract. And I was then given certain roles. I think I had about 12 roles the first year, and they were bit parts, and one major role, which Richard said to me, I'd like you to play Papageno in our John Copley production of The Magic Flute. Yvonne Kenny was coming back from England to play Pamina, and Paul Ferris was our Tamino. So that was the big role, and I thought, oh my God, this is fantastic. I mean, I used to listen to Herman Pry and Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau and all these wonderful baritones singing this. And the funny story was that Richard was sitting in the green room, and he said, oh, don't panic, my dear. He said, Schikaneder was never a singer. So is that a backhanded compliment? Yeah, exactly. I guess in a way.
How do you take that?
But he took me on acting value, and I was the youngest professional Papageno in the world at the time to do that, and I was 21 and had a great success with it, and then did it again with the season during that year, and then had a lovely opportunity to play it again in the Iverfelt production in 99, in that sort of Age of Enlightenment production that Moffat directed at that time. So that was the beginning of being part of the company and just enjoying every day, loving going to work, loving the characters. Once again, not the brothers at the school, but now all those people, from John Pringle to John Shaw to some of the ladies in the principal characters there, and just had a lovely, lovely time with the company.
You seemed set at that time on an operatic course for your career.
Yeah.
So where does something like Guys and Dolls pop up?
Well,
because you know, with Man of La Mancha, there's obviously a seed of musical theatre happening in your youth, and then there's that sidetrack into opera. But show tunes pulling you back.
Okay, so during that time, Carlo Menotti had come to Sydney, and he was sourcing people for the Spoleto Festival. So Moffat said to me, there are a couple of the principal singing in the concert hall. They're auditioning, well, they're singing for him. And so we'd like you to sing, get a couple of arias together and sing those. So I thought, okay, I went to my coach and I sang the Count's aria from Married to Figaro, the recit, and I sang Avant de quitter ces lieux from Gounod's Faust, Valentin. And I walked on and I was nervous as hell, but I sang them, and the reverb was beautiful, the acoustics were great, and I think it might have been Sherilyn Camorley playing for us, or Gary Lakoff, might have been Gary playing, and I sang this, and then I was invited to come down into the stalls, and Menotti was there, and he basically said, I'd like to invite you to come to the Spoleto Festival. I'd like you to learn Die Winterreise and to do the Schubert song cycle there. Now, at the same time, without telling the opera, I had all gone to a cattle call for Guys and Dolls, that same month or whatever it might have been. And I thought, I've done this. If I get it, I'll deal with it then. If I don't get it, it won't matter. I'll stay with the company and maybe become a leader singer, because my voice was light and they were sort of pushing me toward the French repertoire. So I at that point had thought, okay, what do I say to this man? And I said, look, there may be an opportunity for me to go into this musical. And he said to me, you have a beautiful voice, but you can't do both. And here am I at 21 saying, I think I can. And so I ended up getting the role and decided to do it. So I turned that down. Goodness knows what career
what
I may have.
What could have happened, sliding door moments.
Yeah. But I went to Moffat when I was offered it and I said, look, I feel like the bad schoolboy, but I have been offered this role and I'm going to ask you, if you want me to turn it down and stay here because you believe that this is a career path that I should take, I will follow your lead. And he said, Anthony, he said, I think it's a great idea for you to go out there. You need to, in inverted commas, know if you can sleep with these people, being the musical theatre world.
Yeah. Because it's a different discipline, isn't it?
Absolutely. And of course, eight times a week
yeah.
with, you know, sinuses, bleeding sinuses and stuff that I ended up having because I've always had trouble with that. And thinking in those days, I can't go off. If I go off, they're going to fire me. So I pushed through and I lost my voice and I kept singing the role and I did the stuff. And it was trial by fire. And I learned a huge amount. I thanked Moffat and I constantly thank Moffat about, you know, just giving me the go-ahead to do that. It gave me an incredible discipline. It allowed me to play with voices. It allowed me to understand that commercial world. And I came back. He that was the other beautiful thing he said. He said, go away, do this. He said, but please come back to us. And what a beautiful gift to be given. Come back to us.
Mm.
So I came back to do Eisenstein in Fledermaus, which was the production that Joan was doing with Robert Gard. Darling Robert Gard, you know. And so his cheeky monkey said, you're doing me up there. I can see that.
Can you come back for the next few weeks and I'll interview a whole range of people?
Oh, dear. So I ended up doing that. And, of course, I had a bit more chutzpah and I'd found that commercial star, you know, that the opera, the discipline of the opera was different. And I dared, I guess in a way it was kind of a breaking the fourth wall in some regard, but I thought, I can do these little things and I'll try some things, rather than being so stifled and having to go. Because in those days, you know, you were given a role, you went away, you learnt it. It might take you 6 months if it was a major role. You learned it. When you come into that rehearsal room for 3 weeks rehearsal, a repertory company, remember, you need to know it.
Mm.
And then you've just basically got to learn the blocking, but you need to know everything. And in this new discipline, when I got the role, I, as is my wont, to find, you know, a character to come in to audition with, I figured that, you know, this is New York and Skye Masterson would be something like, maybe he came from the Bronx, I don't know, but maybe. So I came in and I did the dialogue this, and I remember they said thank you, and I sang, the song that I sang was Losing My Mind, which I think was the first time they'd heard a male sing it in an audition. And I gave it that male feel. I thought, okay, this is, I'm losing this love of my life, and I'm going crazy. And I think that was the turning point for them. But I heard the director, David, I can't remember his last name, wonderful man. I heard him say...
Suzuki? No.
No, David.
David, he's Japanese.
Yes. You think of it while I'm telling the story. I heard him say, oh, he's learnt the dialogue. I thought...
David Taguri.
He said, he's learnt the dialogue to John Robertson. And I heard this and I went, oh, but yeah, that's what you do, isn't it? And of course, that's not what they wanted. Turns out that they, not only did they not want me to learn it, because I'd done it, I had actually taken over at the last minute and the Arcadians. Lyle Lachetti, I can't remember his last name. He was the Sky in our production, and I was in as a chorus member dancer. And he got sick one night, and Peter Bates, who was the director, he rang me after school, and he said, you've been watching this, you know these songs. He said, could you come and do it tonight? I said, I haven't understood it. I don't know it. He said, look, we'll put the script in a newspaper so you can pretend you're looking at the horses.
Right. You got the horse right here.
So I literally went on stage with my costume and sang the role of Sky. I knew the songs. Nailed Luck Be a Lady because I just loved it. And was just kept looking down at the script in my, Miss Sarah. But when we did it with Nancy and Ricky and Peter Adams, they said this was the London production,
Richard Eyre.
Richard Eyre's production, national production, and it was Ian Charlson who played the role, and we want him to be Southern. And so I went back to my research and I thought, oh, okay, so they're going down the Bat Masterson character, who was an American sheriff, like the good sheriff, wearing the white suit. And so everything had to be a little more Southern, Miss Sarah. And may I make a suggestion, Miss Sarah? And so I was able to do that because I loved the voices and the sounds. And it became a quasi success. I will say this: it was one of the very, and thank God I can say this, few bad reviews that I received, which said that Warlow comes out because of the hat, because of the, it was the Festival Theatre in Adelaide. And David said, we can't see your face. You have to put your hat back. And I had this mop of blonde hair, which when they cut the hair, all the boys got their haircuts because it's the 50s. I looked 12. So with a bit of long hair, I looked a little bit older, but yeah. They cut it and I looked like a 12-year-old. So putting the hair back, the hat back on my head, I looked like Curly out of Oklahoma. And that's what they said. Warlow came on stage singing love beautifully, but like a singing Mountie. And that was my review. So it was a troubled time. And then, of course, I realised years later that Sky and Sarah are two of the most difficult characters in all of the musical comedy canon.
Yeah.
Because, they've got all these crazy characters, cartoon Surround, characters, yeah. buzzing around them, and they've got to have this solid love story.
Yeah.
So that was a great training ground for me.
Dare I say, unless you'd had that experience with the Arcadians of being thrust on mm-hmm. as Sky, you may not have gone to that cattle call.
I may not have.
It was only that, you'd had Sky at some point.
Yeah.
Interesting choice of songs too, with Losing My Mind for that. I heard an interview with Faith Prince once about auditioning for Guys and Dolls on Broadway and going in with a song. And she sang Lady Tiang's song from The King and
I as
Miss Adelaide.
Wow.
He will not always say.
How wonderful. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's so Faith.
Mm.
Faith taught me a huge lesson. And that was, there is no such thing as perfection. Simple. And it was, we were doing this. We're jumping now mega years ahead. But I brought her out to do concerts with me after I'd had a great success with her in and Annie on Broadway, and she sang Adelaide's Lament, and I sang Sumi with her, and then we did a wonderful medley that was put together with some beautiful songs, And I was second, the end of the first act, I was doing soliloquy. And it was always presentational. It's always been, it's like Phantom, put the mic in the middle and stand there and do your show. And we were talking about stuff before this particular performance. And she just put this bug into me. She said, there is no such thing as perfection. And she said, as long as you are truthful, and I knew this, I mean, you know that, but it's when you've been doing something and there's a safety net of yep. This is how I perform this particular number. And so I said to them that night, I said, look, it was Michael Waters who was doing our sound, brilliant man. And I said, I'm going to change this. I don't want to use the stand mic. I'm going to use a bud mic. And I'm just going to walk on and do it. And I hadn't rehearsed it that way. Didn't know where to walk, where to stand or anything. And I sang soliloquy just walking on and presenting it as the character and walking around the stage and changing the scenes. And it was the best performance that I'd experienced. And I looked down in the audience and there were lovely people in the front row with tears in their eyes. And I saw that and I thought, wow, I mean, that Faith Prince, she knows her stuff, you know?
Yeah. Anthony Warlow will step into the shoes of the charming and charismatic, cunning lawyer, Billy Flynn, in our favourite story of murder, greed, corruption, exploitation, adultery, treachery, and all that jazz, the international multi-award-winning musical, Chicago. Join Stages in part two of this riveting conversation with Anthony Warlow as he leads us through stories of recording the iconic Jekyll and Hyde album, his process in creating character, combating illness mid-career, and stellar turns in The Phantom of the Opera and The Secret Garden. Thanks for joining us in this episode. We look forward to your company next time on Stages. I walk a million